Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, look at this. Beautiful morning, great morning. Great week for gardening. Great week for exploring nature. Middle of American summer. Great time on the Gulf Coast. Great time in Alabama. You know, it's different in different parts of Alabama. We're sort of gradually at the end of spring in North Alabama, whereas in South Alabama, we're already well into this advanced summer period, but what a great time. The nights have been wondrously cool. It's one of the great features of this time of year, but it's been really nice now. Hey, you know, I want to talk about a couple of things, I feel obliged to start talking about one thing that is our leftover from our last show. Because it's an important thing to understanding where we are and who we are and what we see. The question was, where did the word Appalachia come from? And you know, if you get up in this, if you get up in the part of the world where the Appalachians are, you're going to get into a lot of arguments about how you pronounce that. You can say Appalachia, you can say Appalachian. But you know, here's the funny thing: the people on the Gulf Coast have as much say in that as anybody. And you may think you don't have much connections to the Appalachians, but it's an interesting thing. You ever heard of the word Appalachicola? Ain't that funny? How did that get its name? Appalachia. Appalachicola. Interesting, it comes from those things we want to forget. The people who lived here before us, the people who understood this land before us, the people who made good use of this land before us, probably abused it too, maybe not as much as we abuse it now. But good people, as good as people come, they were called the Appalachie. The Appalachie were very important. Andrew Jackson decided the Appalachie didn't count. That only the tribes that helped him and the tribes that fought him counted. And so we only know a few names for the nations that used to exist along the Gulf Coast, but one of the biggest was the Appalachie. The last Appalachie village, listen to this, the last Appalachie village, probably the last Appalachie village east of the Mississippi River before they were driven out, was, where was it? Right below the bluff at Spanish Fort at Blakely, a very important Appalachie village, to give you a sense of how important they were to the whole Gulf Coast. And it was a nation that stretched from, had a huge trading network that they controlled all the way from the Gulf Coast all the way up into the Appalachians. And there you go. Interesting thing. Don't forget the Appalachie. Don't forget the Alabamu. Don't forget the Mauvians. Don't forget the Coasati and the Yuchi and all the other tribes that Andrew Jackson wanted us to forget. They were very important. The fish eaters north of Mobile. We should talk about all this sometime. You know, it makes me think, and I think often about how people use the space around them, how people feel about the place around them, how they understand the place around them. And the Indians talking about these old Indian nations remind me of this and what their boundaries were. Their boundaries were the place they understood. Their boundaries were the place they interacted with. They didn't have property in the way we think now. And that's an interesting thing. We have decided that property matters a lot, and I try to figure out why we care about property sometimes and why it's so important to us. Because you know, sometimes I don't think we know it very well. Somebody once said, and a good friend of mine, we were talking, and said, I wonder if we can use some of these new remote sensing GIS techniques to help people garden. And I thought, man, you know, we have the most incredible computer in the world. It's on top of our heads. We don't use it very often. It's connected to these incredible inputs, which are so much more sensitive than any GIS system we have. It's called our nose, our eyes, our ears, our sense of touch. We don't use them in the garden. And so I think about we often come out in the garden and there are we've got, so what's that flower? So we've got a little thing. We now see everything through our phones. We don't see anything in life except what our phones see. It's right. It's wild. So if we see a new plant, the first thing we do is we put our phone on it, we take a picture and see if there's an app that tells us what that plant is. But you know, here's the funny part. Those apps are kind of dumb. They aren't really smart. They're not smart like you are. Now, I'm going to say that you're pretty smart. I believe all people are really smart, naturally. And the differences between the least smart and the most smart of all of us, there just ain't much difference. There is a difference in whether or not we choose to be smart and whether or not we choose to use our senses and whether or not we choose to interact. And so when we go to a phone app and we say, what flower is that? We don't use our nose. And the nose could be really, really important in helping you to determine what flower that is. It might tell you a whole lot. I often use my nose. I you know, there's a ton of plants that I identify by using my nose. There's a ton of plants I identify by using my hands to feel whether they're fuzzy. It's interesting. Don't forget that you and your interaction with nature is the most important thing on your property. I also am impressed now when I see people buy property and I think, you know, it's not because they care about the nature that's going on their property. It's because they hate people, or think they do. Or they want a moat around their property so that they don't have to interact with people. So everything in that moat is just a blasted area. It's just mowed because they don't know what else to do because they don't want to interact with anything. They just want a house in the middle of nowhere where they can watch their television inside. You can do that in the middle of a city. If you have a property, use your nose. Use your eyes. Use your ears. Listen to the birds. I think some plants have sounds too. We could talk about that someday. Use your senses. Interact with your property. Interact with nature. And until you begin that interaction, that sort of full-fledged interaction, that, you know, get right in and touch it. Tell me about what you mean. Why are you here? What are you doing here? How do I benefit from you? You haven't understood your property. You haven't understood it at all. And we're destroying Alabama really fast because we're creating moats around us where we don't care what happens in those moats as long as it's some kind of thing that protects us from all of our fears, which it won't do. But it will destroy Alabama in the process. Understand Alabama. Use your senses. Understand your place. Understand your property. Use your senses. Don't use your cell phone. Don't use your tractor. Don't use your lawnmower. Those are really bad ways of appreciating where you are. Use your senses. Use your taste. Hey, that's what we do. We talk about where we are. We talk about how to take advantage of it. We do it every Sunday morning. We can talk about your garden. I got a lot of questions. I got to answer them this morning. I'm ready. Sort of. We'll have a lot of fun. Stay tuned. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. You can also text us, 251-343-0106. Just text us when you're ready to send me a picture, and you're wondering, what is this thing I saw? I wish I could smell the picture. I can't, but sometimes I can tell visually what I'm looking at. And you should go out, and once I identify it, roll in your hands and smell it. That's the way you really begin interacting with nature. Sometimes you can even taste it. We should be cautious about that, but I taste lots of great plants. They're really fun. Hey, we'll be back. 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood. Slowly I become one with...
All right. All right. It ain't raining right now. Gonna be maybe. So a lot of interesting questions. And a lot of fun things this morning. It could be a lot. It's fun. These are fun questions. So Rusty wants me to know what kind of alligator grass he's looking at. He shows me a picture of a fox squirrel. Rusty, fox squirrels I think of as coastal squirrels more than I think of as hill country squirrels. They love pines. And they love pine savannas. They love the old longleaf savanna habitats. And so there's probably a little bit of longleaf left around you. Not much, maybe, but a little. And you'll often see them. In fact, they're really known as sort of, you do see them up in the Appalachians, but you do see them down on the immediate coast quite a lot because they love the old longleaf. They were really abundant around Mobile at one time. They're now pretty rare because we've wiped out so much of the longleaf and decided that we live in a live oak forest, which we didn't originally. But fox squirrels are cool. I'm going to look at your grass. I'll tell you, I could pretty well tell you without having to... step foot on your property, pretty much what that grass is. I'm going to take a time to do that, Rusty. Some great pictures of people's potatoes. Who is that? Who sent me the great pictures? Josh. You know, Josh is doing things right this year. He's gotten excited. He's done, got a lot of nice things going on. Got a great harvest of potatoes worth thinking about. Because we often think, oh, well, we should plant potatoes when people in New England plant potatoes, and you kind of mess up. So one of the cool things about potatoes is we want to harvest them right now. Josh is doing a great job of it. They look good. They're beautiful. Nice things. And something's coming through. But here's a question from Gary in Grand Bay. What are these multiplying onions doing? Well, there's a spire on one, and that spire is about to flower, and the spire is coming from something that's not a typical multiplying onion. It looks more like a leek, but it's about to flower, and it'll break out into lots of little flowers, maybe into bulbs, but I think that may be some kind of leek. It could be a garlic, but I don't think so. It's a leek or a garlic, and it's about to flower. That's what that spire thingy is. And some other questions, and I'm going to get to them in just a minute. I hear I've got a caller, right? Phil, who's up now? William, is that you?
Yeah, it's me, Bill. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, I don't know if you remember me. I took a couple of your courses at the Botanical Gardens a few years ago. William Terry from Mobile.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Bill. William,
hey, good to hear you again. I'm on my way to work this morning. I'm on call, and I was just pleasantly refreshed by your opening monologue. Beautiful stuff. Love your thoughts and what you're saying there. And it made me think about one of my favorite authors. I don't know if he's ever come up on your show. His name is Wendell Berry. Do you know Wendell Berry?
We've talked to Wendell Berry before, not on this show, but back a few years back, I've certainly read a lot of Wendell Berry over the years. Wendell Berry, folks, is a really famous writer who wrote about developing a relationship with the land and rethinking farming, or maybe rethinking's the wrong word. Understanding how to bring traditional farming forward.
Absolutely, he's kind of a self-described agrarian thinker. He kind of, in almost in the same way Thomas Jefferson was, just really trying to be innovative, but also very respectful to the land and very sustainable. And he also, he posits this idea of the natural size of the human heart is kind of the size of a village, you know, and that when things get too big, that it becomes difficult to have the respect for your place. All that stuff, just you're hitting on a lot of that. And I just encourage anyone who's listening, check out Wendell Berry if they're bored.
Yeah. You know, that's right. And he does a really great job of helping us to rethink farming, thinking about it, slow farming, I guess is one of the things.
Yeah.
You know, we did a series on forestry in Alabama, and my co-writer, Sam Hodges, called Wendell, and he talked to us about it, about forestry in Alabama, and he said, you know, one thing I think you have to understand about doing forestry is it's a really great thing, and it's great for the human soul, and it's great for human values, and it's a great economic thing, but one thing you have to remember about forestry is it's slow, and it should be slow. And we have to begin to think in those terms again. We have to think slow like a forest when we're thinking about agriculture. And he's always just great insights.
There's another wonderful thing he says about how our greatest crop should be the one that's harvested 100 years from now. You know, again, right what you were saying. And he's just very much in tune with natural rhythms, and in a way that I think perhaps we're sort of losing touch with now. Just like you said about the apps, you know, the apps will never be able to tell us that kind of wisdom when we point.
Yes,
point
that's right.
Camera, whatever we're pointing it at. So,
yeah.
Well, thanks again, Bill. I really enjoy hearing you.
Yeah, thank you. And good to hear from you again.
Yeah. All right.
Stay in touch. Sunday. Yeah, you too. Yeah, so, you know, it is interesting. It is interesting to sort of rethink our relationship. You know, we say we want to get back to nature a lot. And then we don't give our body to it. I know that sounds crazy, isn't it? But you got to give your body to it. You got to use your body. You got to use your senses. You got to walk the land. You got to get out of your buggy. You got to get off your three-wheeler. You got to get off your tractor. And then you begin to understand. You got to get out of your car. Lord have mercy, you got to get out of your car. And then you begin understanding the land. You know, I often say that people's view, most people know Alabama. The reason kudzu was such a big deal in Alabama and people thought kudzu was going to take over the world was because the only way people saw the world anymore, the only way people saw land anymore was driving on the highway. Yeah. So they assumed everything in Alabama looked like what they saw on the highway, which it doesn't. For a lot of reasons. And there was kudzu on the highway, and lots of kudzu on the highway. And there was kudzu on the highway because the highway department didn't have better sense. I'm sorry. Didn't say that out loud. Don't. I take that back. Or maybe I don't. Or because the railroads didn't have better sense. So there was kudzu there. But it wasn't in the rest of the world very much. It was kind of not a big deal in Alabama, but that was the only thing we knew was the kudzu on the highways because we never got out of our cars. Take some time today. Use your senses. Use your touch. You know, it's really incredible to go out and touch things. Just touch them. Feel them. Feel the textures of things. It's an amazing thing that happens. Touch is really important to you, to your soul. It changes the way you view things. Smelling is really cool, too. I mean, even stinky things. Sometimes you just want to think, ooh, that stinks. But, you know, I want to smell it again. It's the fun thing. We were out pawpawing the other day. We were looking for pawpaws. Y'all know pawpaws? Anybody want to talk about pawpaws? one of the great neglected fruits of the South. And we were walking around in the woods, and so talking on and on about pawpaws, and I said, hey, reach down, touch this plant. And they said, what is it? And they'd been talking about pawpaws for a while. I said, well, just touch it and smell it. Pick it up. And they kind of picked up and held it. And I said, crush it. It's always hard to get people to crush a leaf. Crush it and smell it. And they said, ooh. I said, what does it smell like? It smells like burned rubber, doesn't it? It smells like somebody peeling off in your driveway, doesn't it? Yeah, it's kind of funny, funky smell. Pawpaw. You'll never doubt what a pawpaw, whether you're looking at a pawpaw, if you learn to smell a pawpaw leaf. It's an interesting smell. It doesn't curdle your blood. It's just very strong and very distinctive, unexpected. Now, the fruits of pawpaw are something else. They smell like bananas and strawberries and pineapple all at once. They're really great. The leaves are just kind of funky smelling, but neat. Use your nose. Hey, we're going to be back. Ooh, boy, I got lots of other questions to answer.
Country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Boy, a lot of fun questions. Carol, you never ask us. You always ask the toughest questions. I mean, it's like, ooh, boy. So Carol wants me to give obtaining a variety of azaleas, fragrant, edible, larger and smaller, sunny and shady. The one thing I can say is I can't give you one that's edible. That I can be sure of. Azaleas are I don't think they're particularly toxic, but they would make you pretty sick if you were to eat any part of an azalea. I don't know of any azaleas that are, in fact, edible, though some of them smell like you could eat them. Our native azaleas, our native honeysuckle azaleas, have an incredible odor that's just incredibly sweet, but I wouldn't eat them. That's going to take a while, Carol. I'm going to think about it. I got to compress that. I mean, we could do 15 shows on that very question. On that very question. What are some of the other questions? Is it too late to start Aji Dulce peppers in seed tray for fall peppers? No, absolutely not. You know, the great thing about those South American peppers, the Caribbean peppers, the Chinense peppers, if you want to get technical about it, and the Bacatum peppers from South America, not the peppers from Mexico, which are a different kind of thing, not the jalapenos, not those, not the bell peppers, surely, but a lot of great peppers do well for us all year long if they're from the Caribbean, and this is a good time to start them. Some of them will overwinter. And so you can kind of think about that a little bit, particularly the Bacatums. The Chinenses are not so good about it, though you could work on that too. But no, you'll get Aji Dulces. You'll get tons of Aji Dulces in fall, particularly along the Gulf Coast. There'll be plenty of time for those to develop. And I would do it now, so you'll get them in fall. One interesting thing about starting peppers from the Caribbean and from the South America, and this is not all, a lot of those peppers start with the word AJI, Aji. And that's basically a word that got used in South America for pepper. And it got extended to a lot of Central American peppers and includes things like habaneros, habanero, and some of those other peppers, but many mild peppers too, like Aji Dulce. Those peppers, it's sometimes really smart to start those peppers while it's still warm in late September or in early September and get them through the winter and then put them out in spring. Now, you could do that and keep them in containers. Just grow them out in containers. You can actually, there's a good chance you'll be harvesting them. If you start them in August, you can probably harvest them through the winter. And that's nice if you've got a nice shady place. Keep them in a container and then plant that whole container out in spring and you won't miss a beat. You're going to get tons of peppers. So there's a lot of options when you're looking at those ahi peppers in terms of when you start them. That's good. I'm glad you asked me that. I've been puzzling. Everybody starts their message with GM now, and I thought, General Motors? What does that mean? Or maybe it's an insult. And so suddenly I realize GM means good morning. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm slow on the uptake on some of these things. Crystal is asking me about her parsley, and her parsley, Crystal, actually spelled out good morning. Thank you, Crystal, because I'm not that smart. And she says they're from the Pine Grove. She's over in Pine Grove, and she has a parsley plant she's had for a couple of years. It's now flowering, which it will do. So winter is going to – they're biennials, essentially, which means that they grow for a year. They go over a winter period or a dormant period, and then – when they've got enough chilling or enough signal that there was a decline in growth, then they will start flowering. And so it's normal. I think it is very hard to manage most parsleys, not all, but most parsleys, when they start flowering, get a good bit of bitterness. You can try it to see what you think. I don't think parsley flowers are all that edible. Now, there are a lot of other things that think it's edible. There's tons of butterflies that'll be on your plant and on your flowers. And different types of butterflies will be using it. And so it's really cool. You can use it for the butterflies once it goes to flower. Here's the other thing you can do when it goes to flower. And this is pretty good and pretty important. You know that plant has done real well in your yard. That means the children of that plant will probably do pretty well in your yard. And when a parsley plant goes to seed, it produces seeds, and those seeds are very good to use in your garden. They're often self-pollinating, as it turns out, seems to be. So you can use those seeds and just scatter them around. You'll have little parsley plants coming up. They're really nice. Or save the seeds and plant them yourself. It's better to have more than one parsley plant flowering and cross-pollinating, but even with one plant, you'll probably get seed, and it's a lot of fun. So there you go. I think it's time to say, let's let this go to seed. Let's let the butterflies have it. They'll probably eat the foliage pretty good too. But at this point, it's so far along that I think you're going to get great seeds any old way. They'll be really good. Jim is asking me about some plants he's got in his yard. The top plant is a begonia. And it's one of the, what do they call those, winged begonias, or it's a foliage begonia. And begonia. And they're really easy to grow, really good, really nice to have. There are a lot of varieties out there. My good friend Linda Guy has gotten all sorts of begonias that she works with. It's a thing. A lot of people really love those begonias. And they're great foliage plants. The flowers are, well, the flowers are interesting, but it's really the foliage that catches your eye, isn't it? There you go. Oh, I see. I see, David. GM means Guten Morgen. Right. Okay. Thank you. That helps me a lot. Jim in Georgetown also sends me a picture of a lily, and that is a crinum lily. Yes, it is absolutely a crinum lily. It's one of the crinum lilies, C-R-I-N-U-M. We do crinum lilies really well in Alabama. It's unfortunate that we don't understand that because we try to do the lilies that people grow out of the Michigan bulb catalog. Do I need to tell you that Michigan ain't quite like Alabama? And so we have, and nothing wrong with Michigan. It just ain't quite like Alabama. So we have a hard time growing a lot of the lilies that they have to, that they grow in Michigan. And they're kind of restricted in the lilies they grow. But we can grow all these wonderful tropical lilies, and crinums, one of them. And we actually have some native crinums. But that is, Jim, that's one of the crinums. It's going to be hard to tell you which one. Because there's a lot of them out there that looks like one of the old cemetery crinums. You often see them growing in old cemeteries. I don't mean to put a depressing face on that lily, because they're really beautiful. They're cool things. We also have cemetery roses, and we don't think disparagingly of them. But it's a beautiful thing. It's one of the pass-along crinum lilies, and a beautiful one, a very nice one, blooming very early. Jim, I would say that one is going to be perfectly hardy. Put it in the ground. It will delay blooming for a year, but then the next year you might not have as big a bloom because it's so excited to actually have some growing room. It's going to just grow for a while. Say, whew, boy, this is fun. I got all this soil. I got a world of soil to grow in, and it'll grow for a while, but it'll get really big, and it will bloom like unbelievable. You will have so many blooms you can't imagine. And the plant, by the way, Jim, I should tell you, the leaves will be more than waist high when it's happy. And the blooms will be, they'll be poking you in the face. Big, big blooming plant. Really big, impressive plant. Crinum lily. Neat thing. Neat thing for Alabama. Patrick is asking me about his Satsuma. I don't think he's called in yet. At least I haven't seen a message yet. Let's see. Is Patrick on? Yeah. Yeah, good. Patrick, I'm listening.
Hey, yeah. So you saw the picture I sent, right?
I'm looking at it right now.
Okay. And, I planted it, and then about a year later, I've looked, and I said, that just looks too close, and I don't want it to bust my sidewalk, but it may not. I was going to see if you could help me with that. I measured it as 27 inches from the edge, and I could easily move it back 1 or 2 feet.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't have that vigorous a root system. It'll probably grow under without moving the bricks a lot. Mm-hmm. And it'll grow right under the bricks. There's no question. I suspect you didn't, because there's no concrete pad there, right?
Right. Those are bricks around a swimming pool, and I'm not sure how they did it. I think they laid them, and they did put a little concrete in there, evidently, because they're real stable. They don't wobble at all. But
well, it'll probably grow under them. But I don't think it's going to move them a lot. I can't guarantee you that there will be no movement. The only thing I'd say about the tree is not so much the roots. I think the roots will be fine for the tree. I think your patio will mostly be fine, too. The one thing is the tree gets really big, and it's a Satsuma, and Satsumas are famous for weeping, and that is they're like a weeping willow.
Mm-hmm.
They're wider than they are tall. So consider that.
Yeah.
That tree is going to be that tree will be. You can count on it being at least 8 feet wide, if not more like 10 or 12 feet wide when it's mature, mm-hmm. and if it's happy. So does that interfere with your pool play? That's the question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So if it does, you need to move it. And the other thing is the limbs are going to be very low because it is weeping, and that's the nice thing about it. That means you can just pick it right off the tree without having to get in a ladder and climb up to get them. Really nice, but you want to consider that. I think it's an okay place if it's just the width of the tree that would be the problem. It sounds like maybe we need to talk just a minute more, but we got to let this little break happen, and then we'll come right back. Okay, Patrick?
Okay.
How the weather in the country? How the weather down south? How the weather in the Delta? How the food tastes in your mouth. Full of beans and cornbread.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Bummity bidoo boo. Okay. Patrick. You still there?
Yes, I am.
So, what do you think? I mean, have you got enough room for the tree there, you think?
Well, I dug a huge hole when I planted that tree, so I could move it over to the edge of the hole easily, like 2 feet back. And I was thinking I would do that just to be safe.
Yeah, so it's not really, I don't think it's going to affect the concrete. I don't think it's going to affect the pad, but it will definitely spread. And that extra 2 feet may be welcome in a couple of weeks. Listen, here's the other thing. Can I talk about hole digging? You don't need to dig a deep hole at all. You mostly want to just dig a wide hole, no deeper than the pot that the plant came in. In fact, anytime you dig a hole deeper than the pot the plant came in, you run into trouble. So remove that grass. Just remove the grass, an extra 2 feet of grass behind where the tree is. Just remove the grass there. That will make all the difference, because the tree's going to have to compete with that grass. And move the tree backwards a little bit. You can just break the soil. You don't need to turn it up. You don't need to add anything special to it. You can just put a mulch on it. But crack the soil an extra 2 feet away from the patio. Move it back like you're talking. And everything's going to work out really well.
Okay, yeah. I dug a hole that deep because when they dug the pool, they hit just pure, like a tan, yellow-colored clay.
Well, here's the problem.
And I didn't know if a tree would live in it, so I dug a big hole and filled that with sand. And so far, everything else I've done that to has worked, but hopefully that'll work in the long run.
That can create problems, and here's why. It's called bathtubs. So when water moves from one soil type to another, particularly from a sand to a very dense clay, it won't move. It just sits there. And the yellow clay will act like a bathtub, and that means this part where the sand is will never drain. It may be that you're lucky and you get some drainage otherwise, but I would never, just in the future, crack the soil, put your plant in there, and put a mulch on top, and it'll do fine. If you change the soil texture, though, deep down in there, you create a bathtub that can create a lot of problems.
Okay.
You don't believe me?
No, I 100% believe you. I just can't believe I went all that work, and I should have just done it the easy way.
Yes, that's right. So I say this over and over, and I don't say it enough, but when you're digging, use the native soil, because if you don't, you're creating more problems than anything else. The topsoil is on the top, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what plants love to grow in, and they really don't have deep roots. Most plants don't, because they can only go down a few inches, and there's no more oxygen, and so the roots stop, because most plants can't deal with low oxygen situations. So what you want to do is you want to crack the soil just so the roots can spread out widthwise as much as possible. You don't have to turn it upside down. You don't have to do anything funky to it. Just crack it, and so that the water can drain down into it as best it can. But you want to keep that native soil, because anytime you change the soil texture underneath, it impedes the flow of water. And then on top, which is where the topsoil is, that's where you add the mulch. Then you can add anything on top. But never dig a really deep hole, and never change the soil texture within the hole. You want to fix the top. Topsoil, always on the top. That's what makes the difference.
All right. Well, I may just move it further back and use the soil, the clay soil that's there, you know, and let grass take over.
That's right. That's right. No problem. And you'll be good. It'll like that spot, by the way, because it'll be a little warmer. The pool mm-hmm. will keep that a little warmer in winter. The concrete will keep it a little warmer in winter. So it should like the spot, and it should be a little bit of extra proof against cold temperatures.
All right.
All right. Good to hear from you.
You too.
Call me back if you run into any trouble. Yeah.
All right. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, no wonder. No wonder David Hubble is speaking German this morning. He sent me pictures of his Melaton. It's blooming. It ain't that weird. It's blooming early. It's cool. And it'll bloom now because David, of course, can tell us why. Because the days are still, it was triggered by the short days. I don't know what'll happen to those, David. That's interesting. You know, of course, as the days get longer, it'll quit blooming and then won't start blooming again until late in fall. But David had this plant growing early enough that it got triggered by shorter days. And look at that, man, cool thing. Keep us posted, David. I'm interested to see what happens if they survive. Those flowers, of course, the plant will survive. David does that real well. It looks good. Alicia, let's talk about these gardenias. And I, you know, we get a lot of calls about gardenias. I talked about them last week. One thing I say about gardenias is don't put them front and center. Because everybody always has a few complaints about their gardenias. And it's just inevitable. They're hard to manage in several ways because they're really susceptible to nematodes. So you got to have a lot of organic matter. They get the really good ones, the ones that flower well, get pretty big, and so you don't want to plant them right next to the front door because you're not going to be able to get in the front door without brutalizing the shrub, and then you don't lose. Then you don't get the flowers. They like a little bit of shade. But not too much. And I guess I shouldn't say they like shade. They love sun. They need sun. They're only going to bloom and get full in really full sun. But if the excessive sun causes the leaves to burn and you run into other problems. So you got to, it takes a careful balance. Here's what I will say about a lot of the gardenias I'm seeing. Is that they're planted in too much shade. And so they're never going to really fill out because they're just not getting enough sun. And so when you plant it, Alicia, I think you're such a good gardener. But when you plant it within 2 feet of a tree, it's going to have a problem. You got to move it out just a little bit. You got to move it out. Oh, I don't know. Move it out from under the trees a little bit. Right along the drip line is a really nice place. So I would say if there's any problem with those gardenias is they're not getting enough sun because they're planted right next to a tree. So that makes it tough for them. Now, they're doing okay given that. It's just they're always going to be a little sparse. They're always not going to flower quite as well as they might have. But if you can bring them out on the, let's say, on the eastern edge, the southeastern edge of the tree shade. So if you go to the drip line of the tree and plant your gardenias there on that southeastern edge, I think they'll do better and they'll bloom better. Of course, those trees are growing too, and that's what you have to think about. And pruning, I guess I got to come back and talk about pruning. I don't think pruning is going to do what you want it to do. We'll talk about it, but I don't think it's going to do what you want it to do. You might call me after this break, and let's talk about it. We'll be back to talk about a lot of other things. So give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106. You can text me, too, with your pictures.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh boy, lots of questions, lots of fun answering them. We're going to do fine this morning. Tillman sent me, he says it's a crazy if not insane question. It's not, and I'm going to get to it, blackberries. We need to talk about that. David explains that he's got this melaton that he's got that's flowering is a 10-year-old vine, and he'll get some fruits out of it this spring. For us, that's sort of a lagniappe. We don't expect the fruits until fall, but if you do it right, like David does, sometimes you get them in spring, late spring, American summer to be precise, because it's already American summer in South Alabama, right? The question about onions, you know, be careful when you plant onions. That's all I can say. Keep up. You ought to know the name of the onion that you're planting. And if you know the name, then you're going to be in a good shape. And then you can check to see if that onion is going to be well adapted to the Gulf Coast. I'll say this about onions. I need to always remind us about onions. A lot of onions were developed for the poor folks up north who have short days in winter and long days in summer. Very short days in winter. And they're called long day onions because they won't bulb until they get to the long days of summer, etc. We grow short day onions. That's what we need in Alabama, virtually everywhere in Alabama. It may be in the very northern part of the state you could grow some intermediate onions, but really we need onions that are designed for the South, and that's Granix hybrids, Spanish, the Spanish reds, Bermudas. There's Bermuda, as people say. What are some of the others that we grow here? Of course, Walla Wallas are not grown well here because they're really developed for a very different day length that you get. Day length changes. You know this? Do you appreciate this? So, you know, the thing that happens in the Arctic is that during the midwinter, the days are so short, there's not even really a day. There's just like a flash of daylight. I mean, a flash, literally. Whereas if you're in the equator, the days are the same length all year long. Barely vary. They vary just a little, but just barely. So we're somewhere in between, and day length matters to a lot of plants. And so we have to have the right onions for those kinds of day lengths. And you got to think about that. So I don't know what kind of onion you have. So I don't know whether I can tell you whether you need to hang on or not. So if you know the name, you can tell me and I can give you a good sense of whether or not it's going to bulb up. If you don't know the name, you're just going to have to kind of wait it out. It ought to be starting to bulb up by now, I'll say. And I can't guarantee it won't. It may, depending on the variety. But just when you're planting onions, be really careful about it, because people will sell you, you know what they'll sell you. So just be careful. We'll find out what kind of onions they are soon. Somebody asked me about a fungus growing on an azalea. It's actually a gall, which is a little different than a fungus. I think this is not caused by a fungus, but actually caused by an insect. It's an insect gall. It's not a big problem. The azalea doesn't really care. The azalea gets to go on doing what it does. The insect gets to go on doing what it does, and never really a problem. It scares people, I know, because it looks weird and different. But, you know, you can cut it off if you like. It may prevent your getting a few more next year, but probably won't make much difference either way. There'll be plenty of other azaleas for the gall to grow on, and the gall-forming insects will come back to your azaleas. It doesn't really hurt the azaleas. So I don't know. It's one of those things that it really pays off if you don't worry about it. Because then you can use your time to think about things that will matter. So I would say don't worry about the gall. It's going to be okay. It's a good thing. It's a fine thing. It's nature at work. Not really a fungus, not really infecting the whole plant, just a little home, a little bitty home on the edge of a leaf for some kind of little gall-forming insect. That's about what it is. Alicia, thank you for calling. Can we talk about those gardenias now? Ooh. Alicia, make it?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
Good morning.
Didn't give up on you. So let's talk about your gardenias. You heard my thing about, I think they're a little close to the trees, right?
Yes, I inherited them.
And that means they're not getting enough. Yeah, so it ain't your fault. That's good. And I don't think pruning's going to make it a difference. I don't think pruning is going to make a difference. I mean, basically, the plants are struggling for enough light now. And when you start pruning heavily, you remove leaves, which makes them struggle even more. So remember that plants feed themselves, and they feed themselves by photosynthesis, by absorbing sunlight. It won't matter if you add fertilizer or anything else, because they're limited in how much fertilizer is just grease for the wheels. It just sort of makes the whole photosynthesis thing, the wheels turn on the photosynthesis, but the food being processed really comes from sunlight. That's where they get all their sugars. And so it doesn't help if they don't get more sunlight. I think they're doing okay, given where they are. Now, what you might want to do is layer them and gradually layer them away from the plants. Walk them away from the plants. I know that sounds crazy weird, but let's talk about what that would mean. You can take one of the longer stems, several of the longer stems, and lay them down, pull them over without breaking them, pull them gently over till they touch the ground, and make a little curve right about 6 inches from the tip so that it sticks up, and bury that in the ground. Bury that little curve part in the ground. You see what I'm saying? About 6 inches from the tip, bury that curve in the ground, staple it in, and it will root. And you'll have another gardenia, 4 feet away from your mother plant? And it'll be a little farther away from the tree. And it will get a little more sunlight and may do a little bit better.
Well, if I decided to move them, when would be the best time to do that?
You're going to have a really hard time moving them because they're sitting right there in all those tree roots. But you can try. The best time to do it isn't going to be in fall. Don't do it now. You'll regret it.
Okay.
And that's why I think, because of all the tree roots, I think it's going to be really hard to move them. So that's why I'm trying to get you to layer them and start a new plant. And that new plant could grow pretty quick. So
that's
probably a better way of doing it.
It will be difficult,
yeah.
So I may not try that.
Yeah. I mean, life's important. Time's limited. Moving gardenias, it don't fit.
Well, I have one other question.
Layering them is really easy. Yes, ma'am.
Gardenias, the onions.
Yeah.
When the flowers fall over on a multiplying onion, is that when you dig them up to dry the bulbs?
A lot of multiplying onions, you really should never have to dig up and move around, but you certainly can. You want them to, you can move them around now. And when the flowers move over, it would be a time to do it. And I would say, that's interesting. I would say later May is when I would normally move them, but now is probably a fine time too. You could probably move them now.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alicia.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, we're going to be back. We got to deal with these Taiwan cherries.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night too.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
There you go. So I get a message from Greg saying, hey, I'm not listening to your show. And I'm happy. And yes, sirree. It's all right to not listen to my show if you're out in the middle of the Delta. That's a thing to do. That's a thing to do. But he just wanted to tell everybody hello. It's a good thing. Being out there with the real thing. I'm only partially the real thing. Hey, here we go. We got a lot of questions. I'm going to try to get to them all. I think I kind of rounded up most of the questions we're on, but the Taiwan cherry, I said I'm going to talk about it. Listen, let me talk about cherries for just a second. There aren't many cherries that will survive and bloom for any time in Mobile and on the Gulf Coast. If somebody tries to sell you whatever the cherries are in Washington, D.C., They might as well sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, because it ain't going to grow well in Alabama. It ain't going to bloom worth a toot, because it doesn't get enough chill hours along the Gulf Coast. I you know, even as far north as Montgomery, I don't recommend most cherry varieties, but there's a couple that we do recommend. One is Taiwan cherry. And with a name like Taiwan, you can feel pretty good that it comes from a climate similar to the Gulf Coast. It actually is quite similar to the Gulf Coast in many ways. It's humid. There's not a lot of winter on most of the island, and so Taiwan cherries do quite well here, and so we often recommend them. And to me, Taiwan cherries blow the other cherries out of the water. I mean, they just got incredible color, deep color. They bloom in February. They're great. They're wonderful trees. One thing I'll tell you about all cherries, and that is, even Taiwan cherries are fairly short-lived here along the Gulf Coast. Cherries are short-lived everywhere. It's just the way they are. They aren't long-lived trees. Black cherries are different, but that's a different big cherry, native cherry. But most ornamental cherries are fairly short-lived. Taiwan cherries live longer than most cherries. Almost all cherries, ornamental cherries along the Gulf Coast, but they still don't live very long. And one of the reasons they don't live long is they're subject to a lot of diseases and a lot of borers and a lot of insects and a lot of dieback. So I've got a couple of pictures of trees where there's dieback on the trees. And that's pretty typical of cherries. Now, I will tell you, if the trees that have the dieback just on the tips, you'll lose that branch. The rest of the branches are going to branch out. They're going to do just fine. That's a dieback. It's a limb dieback caused probably by diseases, various kinds of diseases whose Latin names I don't remember. But we call them things like gummosis. It's just a localized disease that can be rather localized on the tree. And it's already happened. It's already done. The tree is through the period of time when it's susceptible to that disease, because it's a lot of those diseases are really very aggressive in spring. I don't think you'll have as much problem with that disease the rest of the year, but it'll show up again at some point. Don't worry about it, because if the tree is well rooted, it's going to branch out and it'll keep growing for 15 or 20 years. And you know, that's pretty good, and it's going to be really pretty, really beautiful. In the meantime, it flowers. It's very precocious. It flowers almost immediately. So you'll have great... That tree is going to be fine. There's a little bit of dieback in the top of one of those Taiwan cherry pictures I got today. Not anything you can do about it. You can't fix it. I guarantee it. You're not going to stop it. I guarantee it. But you know what? The tree is going to do okay. It's going to keep growing, and it's going to be fine. Somebody else sent me a picture of a Taiwan cherry, and the whole tree, it looks dead. I mean, there ain't a leaf left green on it. I'm not sure what to say about that one, except it may sprout from the roots, but I think that the person who sent me the picture diagnosed it pretty well. I think it's in too wet a spot. And no, most plants don't like to be in a wet spot. I think it'll help if it were planted elsewhere. I think at this point I would leave that tree there, because moving it with that much after having undergone as much trauma as it already has, I mean, you can only imagine what it's going to be like to move it. It's really not going to have enough energy to survive the move. So leave that one there. Find another Taiwan cherry for a slightly better drained area. If you want to know what to do in those wetter areas, let's talk about that. You can call me and we can figure that one out. I don't want to give you advice you don't want, though. So give me a call. Give me a call. And Tillman, now I got to talk about Tillman's thing, which is interesting. So Tillman says, I want to grow some blackberries or dewberries. What's the best way to achieve growing a blackberry patch? Well, that's a great question. I think it's an outstanding question. Because to me, cultivated blackberries they're not as good. I'm just going to put it to you. I don't think they're as good. And I guess they're easier because they don't have thorns sometimes. And I guess, you know, I don't know. But they're hard to manage, the cultivated blackberries. And I don't think they taste as good. But wild blackberries they're a little bit tartar. But actually, I think that's really what makes them what they are. They're really good that way. You know, it's okay if you add a little sugar. But that tartness really adds to the depth of flavor, and I think wild blackberries are better. So Tillman's asking a very good question. I will say this. In my experience, Tillman, dewberries are hard to manage. And dewberries are really hard to manage because dewberries are those short little blackberries that never get very high. And so you're always trying to keep things from covering them up. And at the same time, they're always trying to cover over things that you're planting. I think dewberries are really fine things. It's really hard to catch a lot of fruit off of a dewberry unless you happen to be a box turtle. I think box turtles are masters of dewberries. They will eat every dewberry before you even find it. So they're good about that. But dewberries are hard. So blackberries, if you find a good patch of blackberries, what's the best way to spread those blackberries? Ooh, I don't want to be bad. I don't want to even be gross. But let me say, once a blueberry gets digested, it's gonna germinate really fast. But you can take some blueberries. You can take those blueberries and just spread them in your yard. Spread the fruit. Let them get really ripe on the vine, maybe riper than you would like to actually eat them yourself. Just put them in a little pot. Find a place where you want those, blackberries, and put them there. They're going to want bare soil. They're going to want lots of sunlight. And just spread them out there. They're going to come up like crazy. And you'll be great. And then you can harvest them. That's how you do it. It's that simple. You need to find the wild patch first. If you can get a bird to pre-digest them for you and put them in the right place, like, you know, talk to a bird, see if they'll come sit on your fence post and do what they do when they sit on fence posts, you know, you'll get a patch right there too. That's how most blackberries get spread around. Let me tell you something else about blackberries. And this is why cultivated blackberries are a problem. Blackberries move around a lot in the wild, and they do that because they collect diseases like crazy. And plants deal with diseases in lots of different ways. But blackberries deal with diseases by moving around. They get the mockingbird. They say they hitch a ride on a mockingbird and wait for a mockingbird to put them on a different fence post, and there you go. And that way they don't collect diseases. They escape diseases. So when you build your blackberry patch, realize that it's probably going to last 4 years max, and then you want it to move on. You could burn it. That would help. Gets rid of some of the diseases, but that may be a problem in most yards. Tillman, am I helping at all? Does that help? Because, yeah, I appreciate, we have forgotten how good blackberries are. I mean, just an incredible thing, blackberries. And wild blackberries are the best. We're spraying herbicides all over the dadgum roadside. We're mowing everything to oblivion. Lord have mercy, get off the lawnmower. Not everything has to be mowed every month of the year. We could have more blackberries. We could be rich. We could have blackberry cobbler. And instead, you're out there mowing the damn grass. Ooh.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right around.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Boy, I got a lot of questions to answer. Let me start by talking about Susan DeGreer. Susan sent a picture of her husband working in the garden, and it was so exciting that she was the overwhelming favorite to win the contest this week for our Facebook page contest. We got a Facebook page. And she won with that picture, and Susan gets the Wonder Wheel. If you don't know what the Wonder Wheel is, you have to, I guess, win the contest. We're going to work on getting the Wonder Wheel out to other people. I got to talk Sean into it. But it's a cool thing, the Wonder Wheel. It's sort of a guide. You can actually get it on the internet, but, you know, we got it on this really nice poster. And it means you can put it up and you know exactly when to plant things along the Gulf Coast. It's really cool. It's been acclaimed. Not by Boston. Boston doesn't care about the Wonder Wheel. They don't get any acclaim from Boston. Well, you get it all from the Gulf Coast because they say, wow, this thing works. It does work. It's been time tested. It's really great. Tells you when to plant things. Really useful. It'll surprise you because we don't have the same planting cycle that people up north have and that people talk about. A lot of other questions I need to answer. So Susan won this contest this week. She got the poster. You can submit your pictures to Facebook, and it's pretty pictures. It's interesting pictures, pictures that catch people's imaginations. Maybe it's just super gross pictures that people are fascinated by. Oh, not anything too gross. But, you know, it's a fun thing to do. So give it a try. Look at the Facebook page. People vote for it. And Susan won this week. Congratulations, Susan. Boy, a lot of other questions I want to get to, and some I just want to ask. A soil test, and I'm going to, you know, I'd love for lots of people to hear this. So what is the best soil test? And I will tell you, most soil tests don't work. And it depends on what you need to know and what you want to know. And I am not one of those people who says, oh, you got to have a soil test to start your garden. I can just about tell you, nah. If you're on the Gulf Coast, nah, you don't need a soil test. I can tell you what's up with your soil. And the thing that most soil tests aren't designed to do is to tell you how much organic matter is in the soil and how much space there is between particles in the soil. And those are two really big, important issues. More important than anything else. Honestly, really more important than anything else. And no soil test tells you that. There are some that are better at doing organic matter. They're quite expensive. Auburn is doing those. And I'm glad they've updated it. But I can just tell you. And so call me. If you think you need a soil test, let's talk about it. Let's talk about your yard. Let's talk about what we can tell without getting a soil test, and that's quite a lot. Very easy to sort of diagnose your soil problems and to fix them without a soil test. It's a soil test, a conventional soil test, and soil test kits are exceptionally useless. I'll tell you that. I don't recommend a soil test kit, not one out there that'll do well. Ooh, let's see, what else am I not getting to? The question about when to plant a Japanese maple. You know, you can plant a Japanese maple any time of year as long as you remember to water it. If you're not good about watering frequently when you first plant something, do not plant that maple now. Wait until this fall. It's a lot easier. However, if you have it in pots, if you've already bought it and you have it in a pot, you got to plant it now, because one way or another, you got to water it and remember to water it, and it'll be a little better off in the ground than it will be in a pot. So there it is. You can plant it any time of year. Planting it in fall gives it a long time to get established without your having to worry about watering it frequently, and that is a big issue. So chances are you can water that thing in fall. You can put it in say, October or November, and just water it once and forget about it. Maybe you'll be okay for the rest of the time. That's it. There it is. Hey, Barry, I want to say the iris is the invasive iris. Pretty clear. It's not the native iris. It is the invasive European iris. Gosh, I can't believe how much we're seeing that. It's really worrying me. I hope it doesn't destroy our wetlands. But that is the invasive European iris, that yellow iris, not a native. Just to let you know, Barry also asked me about a couple of plants. Barry, use your nose. Use your nose. This is the time when you interact with your garden and you use your nose. Really important. Take those leaves on those little trees, crush them, and smell them. And just, crumple them up and crush them. They're going to smell like eucalyptus. They're going to smell like camphor. They're camphor trees. They're the invasive, I have to use the word invasive too many times, but they're the invasive camphor trees. They don't do as much damage to woodlands, but boy, they can be a nuisance in the yard. They will seed in like crazy, like insanely crazy. I would not recommend keeping them around. It's a camphor tree. Use your nose. You'll smell it. You'll never forget the smell. You'll always know a camphor tree. You'll never mistake it for anything else. If it doesn't smell like camphor, then you gotta come back and tell me, you idiot, that's not a camphor tree. Here's what it smells like. And then I could tell you, well, maybe one of those is a red bay. But I think both of them are camphor trees. Both of them are camphor trees. Smell them. Tell me what they smell like. They smell like camphor. You know you got it. You hit it on the head. Well, we got a lot of callers, and I don't want to. Who's Arlen? Have you been on there this whole time? And I've been talking. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, just driving down the road, so hanging out, listening to the show.
All right. Well, thanks. So tell me what's up.
I got two blueberry bushes. One of which has two volunteers on it, and they produced berries last year and again this year. I was wondering the best time to relocate those, and if there's any special precautions I got to take when I do that.
Yeah, so a lot of blueberries are slightly, I guess I'm going to call it rhizomatous. It's not. It's stoloniferous, but they make a clump and they spread out. So here's what you do. Look around the base of that plant and look for sprouts that are moving out from the main trunk. That there's a little bit of separation. There should be a few if the blueberries have been there a while.
Okay, yeah.
How long you had those blueberries? Yeah.
Probably about 8 years.
Oh, yeah. You got them. So take a spade. I love a spade. You know what a spade is?
I do.
Use a spade and sharpen it. You ever sharpened a shovel? It makes all the difference. Sharpen that spade. Take just a mill file. Sharpen one side. Get a little bit of sharpness. Take that spade and just drive it in the ground between the sprout that you want to keep and the mother plant. The sprout that you want to move and the mother plant. And wait. Just wait. That means the young sprout will develop its own root system separate from the mother plant, and then this fall, dig it up and move it.
Okay, so use the sprout then, not the existing ones that have grown. They've gotten long about 4 feet and had berries on them. Just leave them.
No, I mean,
and use them sprouts.
Oh yeah, no. Okay. Don't make life hard.
Okay. Okay,
use,
great.
Use the younger sprouts. Yeah, and the younger sprout could be 3 feet tall. It could be waist high. I wouldn't use the tallest ones, though. Use right. ones that are well out from the plant, that are easy, and just slice it off, let the roots develop, and then move it this fall.
Okay, great. Yep. This fall, got it. You got time for another quick yep. one? Two guys, a guy gave me a couple of apple pears, and he said plant them and see what happens. One of them came up, and it's about 18 years old, and it's about 10 feet high, but it hasn't bloomed or produced fruit. It doesn't seem to have.
A lot of interesting questions.
I even got an apple pear tree, to be honest, but I mean, it's healthy.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we know what an apple pear is. So here's the first thing. We got to figure out what it
I don't know. If
prickly pear.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, it was tasty when I got up there in St. Stephen's, and it was really tasty. You know, like.
You talk about with a cactus, with the little cactus pad?
No, it's, well, I guess that could be. It was a large tree, and it was just loaded with fruit.
Huh.
They looked
you know
similar
what?
To pears, but they weren't, I guess they were as hard as pears as well, but they just had a good flavor to it.
Okay, well, interesting series of common names here. So I'm going to guess that an apple pear is a type of Asian pear. That has rounded fruit.
Right.
A lot. It's not easy to propagate those. And so I don't know what he gave you, which is interesting, too. Did he give you a seedling?
No, it was the fruit itself. And, you know, I took my knife and ate a bunch of it and then stuck the two cores in a couple of pots.
Ooh.
One of them came up. I planted it.
Well, okay. So. Oh boy, we gotta have to have a lesson in. I'm gonna say this as delicately as I can. We gotta have a lesson in sexual reproduction.
Okay.
Here's the funny thing. If this doesn't hurt your ears on a Sunday morning.
No.
There's no guarantee that the seed that you took from that pear is going to be like the parent at all.
Right.
Plus the fact that, and because it could be cross-pollinated. It could be a clone, and I know this will drive you crazy because humans aren't capable of creating clones very well, at least with humans. And so we don't understand what a clone really is. It could be a clone seedling that's possible with pears, but still, starting from seed, it could be 20 years before you see any fruit.
Wow. Okay.
So
I
really what you want.
Somebody mentioned cross-pollinating, so I did plant another similar tree.
Yeah, well, oh boy, it's going to be tough. To produce fruit, you actually don't need cross-pollination, but it may get cross-pollinated, and if it does, that means you're not going to get the same thing as the parent.
Okay.
Oh, we could do a whole show on this.
Right. Well,
you can call me back next week.
I mean, like I said, it looks like it's healthy and it's growing fine. Should I prune it or
yeah,
anything?
And don't
or
let it take
it or go.
No, not a thing you can do to it except give it time and make sure it's not taking up space you could be doing something better with.
Right. Well, I sure appreciate the help, Bill. Good talking to you.
All right.
Enjoy the show.
Yep.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, turn that music down. We got a lot of work to do here in a very short period of time. Is it Aubrey or Lisa? Are Aubrey or Lisa related? I can't figure it out. But they both asked me. I'm going to tell you the picture that Aubrey sent me is a picture of spiderwort. Some people like to say spiderwort, but it's more like wort. Spiderwort is what I'm sticking by. Spiderwort, Tritus candida. Is it a wildflower or a weed? Well, you know, it is definitely a wildflower. It gets a little bit weedy. It can get a little bit weedy in yards around the Gulf Coast. And then it gets a funk and something, but it's, you know, it's kind of a fun thing to have. It's not a terrible thing to have. If it starts interfering with the growth of your lawn, you might worry about it. It's both. It's Tritus candida. Some people sell Tritus candida. I mean, you'll see, you go to a white flower farm and they'll be selling you a Tritus candida that isn't any prettier than that. And it'll be, God, you know, $15 a plant. And you got it growing like wild in your garden and your yard. So not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. Lisa, call me back next week and let me figure out what you mean by spider lilies. You're going to have to call me. And let's talk about it next week, because we're going to run out of time this week. And I gotta kind of know a little bit more about the situation. Let's try it again next week. Meanwhile, boy, do I have a long list of callers. We got to do Flash. We got to do the lightning round. Thomas, I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah, I sent you a picture earlier this morning. I've got a holly that is growing suckers along the trunk. And wanted to find out a good way to get rid of those and prevent them from coming back.
Yeah, the only way to prevent those from coming back is to cut the tree down at ground level and then herbicide it. So you're going to have to prune that tree just a little bit. There's not another way of doing it. You just have to prune it. Now, I think you'll get fewer of them as time goes on, but for the time being, it's just going to take regular pruning each year, and probably a couple or three times each year, given our climate and given how long things, you know, what a long growing season we have. But
before, and it seems like they come back thicker after I prune them.
Yeah, sometimes that happens. You kind of need to prune them all flush. It can be tough, and some varieties are better at dealing with that than others. You just got to prune them. Send me I'm going to take a look at your picture. Call me back next week. I'm going to take some more pictures closer to the trunk next week and make me think about it a little harder next week. Let me make sure you're pruning correctly, but I'm going to need some better pictures. I think you probably are, and I think it's just called work. And I mean, whether it's worth it or not, I don't know. But you know, we'll talk about the alternatives next week.
All right, thank you, Bill.
All right, thank you. Let's see what else. Who's our next caller? Help me out, Phil. Who's next? I'm listening. Who's up? Darlene, I'm listening.
Yes, all right. This is Darlene, Gene's wife, who calls you all the time.
Yes, ma'am.
About his bananas.
Yes, ma'am.
And satsumas. Now.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. He took all our plants out of the hot house, and everything looks good except some of these that have the long, dark green leaves, shiny leaves, and they're very dull looking. I mean, they're not even a dark, rich green anymore. So what can I put on them?
I wish I knew what they were. this is all different kinds of plants?
Bloom on them, bloom every spring, like a prayer plant or something. Peace lilies. He yelled in the back.
Peace lilies. Ah. Uh-huh. Yeah, so the leaves will look a little better as time goes on, but they certainly respond to a little bit of fertilizer.
Okay.
I would use if they're in a container, I would say use Miracle-Gro.
Okay.
Or something like that. And let me not say the brand is not important. What's important is that it's a liquid fertilizer. Mm-hmm. You don't want a brand that has a lot of phosphorus in it, so I try to simplify it by saying Miracle-Gro, because I know it doesn't have a lot of phosphorus in it.
Yeah, we've used that before and all that. All right, we'll give it a try.
Mix a batch up. That ought to Yeah, it ought to be good, and
I've got several.
Yeah, it ought to be better.
Anyway.
You know, one of the interesting things is
we do them every week, but we only do them every other week.
You don't need to. Peace lilies don't need that much fertilizer. You don't want to fertilize them too much. I would say once a month, at the most.
Yes, once a month.
Okay.
Yes, okay. Ma'am. All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.
All right.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Phil, we still have time. I'm doing this, Phil. So tell me who's up next. We got help me out. Who's coming up next? Joey, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill, it's Joey Guess.
Hey, Joey, how are you?
It's about 15 years old. It never put out. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, it put out one orange. Last year, they put out a bumper crop of blood oranges, and they was delicious. This year, it went to bloom, and it had about seven little blooms on it with little bitty oranges, and they all fell off. What went wrong?
Cold. Blood oranges are much more sensitive to cold than satsumas. And so we'll get good years because the winter's warm and the buds aren't damaged. And then we'll get cold years when most of the buds get damaged. I would say in Mobile, more years than not, you're going to lose the flowers and buds. Blood oranges are a little more sensitive to cold, and that's it. And so how do you deal with that? That's one of the reasons I grow blood oranges in containers. But if you have a blood orange tree that you have outside, I would say get you a frost cloth, Joey. Joey, it's good to talk to you, by the way. And get you a frost cloth and just drape it over the top. Just pull it over the top, any kind of tarp. On those cold nights, even a blue tarp will work. And just pull it over the top on those coldest nights. You'll get a little bit of leaf burn, but it will protect most of the flower buds, and you'll do a little bit better. And so anytime temperatures drop below about 28 degrees, which isn't that often, if you pull the tarp over it, you'll be able to get it past, you'll be able to get those buds. It's usually temperatures below 25 that cause the most damage, and particularly if it's below 25 for a lot of hours. And I think we've had some of those nights here recently. So it's just cold, Joey, just cold. And blood orange is a wonderful thing, but boy, they can be really sensitive to cold. Joey, it was good. Man, I'm sorry, folks, if we missed some of your questions. Call me back next week. We do this again next week, and we'll talk to you about all the different things going on. Meanwhile, you get to listen to Louis Gottschall. David Hubble, you ought to tell us all about Louis Gottschall someday. We'll be back.